Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Blind one, how can you stumble on a straight, spontaneous path? Be spontaneous in your own self and find the way that is born in you. Words of wisdom describing God can reveal us riches in a darkened room. Seeking in darkness is confusing. Break the barriers and look at the sky. The formless is held as a beautiful form in the arms of the moon. Now that's also from the bowels. Now we started that last week and gave the sort of a background, broad general background of how they came about. And they are called also the Sufis of India. They're sort of the loners, as it were. They do group together, but they don't have a specific tradition, such as Vedanta or Buddhism or the Jains, so on, you know. So anyway, so we're going to continue a little with that, because there are some very interesting points that they have that I think I should call to your attention. And this is the easiest way to do it. In some ways, you know, the people of the West have been fortunate. Of course, we have been in the search of science, as it were. We have this thing of we want to know what it is. And in the East, they also want to know what it is, but their search is in religion. And actually, in the religious search, their search is greater than ours in the West. And yet, we are freer to seek. We do not have to obey the rules of the Vedas, which is the backup, the backdrop for all of the accepted religions in India. They must come out of the Vedas, and we obey the Vedas. We don't have this here. So the people of India are imprisoned in a way by caste and by family customs and by routines, life routines. Of course, we do have also our family customs to which we are molded, and we have life routines to which we are also molded. And I think we do not realize how molded we have been in our young years by our very family, by our customs and our routines. But as a consequence, because they were so imprisoned, so much more so than we have been, they begin to describe their, where they began a long time ago, to describe their worlds, and they use a vocabulary of imagery. And they use this form of description, this imagery that they have, they used it as a form of escape from their daily drudgery, because the Indian people, as we know, have been very poor. They're lifespan was very short, and so, you know, use the imagination and imagine a world better than this. And this Eastern type of imagery, actually, Our Christian Bible was also written in that Eastern imagery. And there are people who live in ashrams in India, and we call them communes here now. And they lived, or if they didn't live in an ashram, they lived around it, you know, maybe in a close village, somewhere where they could be in touch with a teacher. And it allowed them a very passive life. They would come asking for blessings. They wanted to live in the teacher's orbit, in the aura, as it were. And after all, it's a lot easier to exist like this in a shadow passively and to watch how the teacher lives and to be very happy when he in his accomplishments and, you know, and be very sad if somebody crosses him or something like that. It's a lot easier to pay attention to somebody like that than to struggle for yourself. Also, in order not to struggle, they invented and they played games. And I can't leave it with they. We do a certain amount, more or less, at different times, different places, different people, you know, because of the pressure that we live under, you know. We play games. We play games with ourselves, and we play games with our friends, and we play games with our families, and we play games, period. And you try to play games with me. So it's easier to do that than to fight your way for this enrichment of consciousness, huh? Or the evolution of consciousness. It's easier just to your way along. Yeah. And I think that by now most of you have learned that no matter what technique we may use, whether it's an old tradition or a more recent tradition or whatever method you're trying to find out something about yourself, simply by wishing, we cannot change. We can't change ourselves, our character. But if one gives effort to it, through this effort, we can become sufficiently free of it, sufficiently free, by making it very supple, that is kind of bendable, pliable. And one looks at oneself enough so that this barrier that is in ourselves included, you know, it's like we've got this hard shell. And, you know, it's kind of like concrete and it's dogmatic, you know, that you, it's not bendable at all. You know, if you go like that at it, it breaks instead of bending. So we've at least gotten rid of that. See, when it is sufficiently free, there is what is called remainder. For a long while, there is remainder. There's two kinds of remainders. What remains when we have become sufficiently free of being dogmatic and hardened is the formation of being. There is a nakedness, we are stripped bare, as it were, you know, so that this being can now be seen. And the Baals say, one must experience the process before undertaking a more advanced discipline. The process is the observation of oneself. You know, this constant looking. It is the trying to live within oneself. The way we are in this great nature. You know, they talk about a jeweler. Now, a jeweler, when he fashions a ring, a gold ring, he uses gold and an alloy. Do something with it, you know. And they speak in this manner. He is a smelter. He is like a smelter, you know, putting the alloy and the gold together in the form. He is like a smelter when he works in the descending movement. And he is an artist engraver in the ascending movement. And he is liberated only when he has truly fashioned the ring. Now, it would be, I think, rather ridiculous to believe in a possible liberation without having descended many, many times to this very foundation of being, to this, where we know that this mysterious seed in us, which we basically are, where this life of this great nature is hidden. I mean, you know, we sit for meditation to arrive at this seed within ourselves, this foundation. You know, Meister Eckhart, you know, he put it so well. It's the ground, the Urgrund, the ground under everything. It's the ground on which I live. It's the ground on which I walk. Urgrund, the seed of being. Now, in a manner of speaking, in a way, the Christian individual, as we have been reared and taught, we live in this world rather as a child lives in his father's house. We accept its construction, and we do not do much probing. You know, we are just here with our family, and that's nice, and someday we'll know more about it, maybe. Of course, you know, and then, of course, the scientists are after much more than that, but they do probe. But the average Christian individual, this is his father's house, and he lives in it more or less contentedly without so much seeking, so much probing. Now, also in Christianity, we do not have a cosmogony. That is, we do not have a doctrine of creation. In Genesis, this is our doctrine of creation, huh? In Genesis, God says, let there be, and there is. Period, end of report. That's, do you comprehend that? This the Spirit of God walked on the face of the waters and says, let there be. And there is. See, that's all. You know, in India, they have all these gods and goddesses that are all doing all these different kinds of things. In Egypt, they had the same thing, all these gods and goddesses that were doing all kinds of things, creating the world and setting it in its place and, you know, and in Greek we had it, and you go through the islands in the Pacific, and they all have creation doctrines. We don't in Christianity. See, when God says, let there be, this is will. It is a will that we do not understand. It is a will that we can feel. I mean, once in a while it is revealed to us, but you're still not going to understand it. We speak of laws, and we speak of great laws, the laws that move mountains and move glaciers, and you know, the law, great law of gravity, and the people speak of the law of karma, and they speak of the law of the Dharma, or the law of the truth, these great laws within which we live. Have you ever seen them? Do you know the force of them? Do you have any inkling of an idea of the force of them? Have you ever felt any of them enough so that you could say, oh yes, this is this particular law? Have you felt the force of God's will? And out of the Old Testament, you know, can anyone understand the thunderings of God's pavilion? Elihu asks Job, do you know the ordinances of the heavens, how the clouds are balanced or the lightning shines? Do you know how the lightning shines? Have you comprehended the expanse of the earth, or on what its bases were sunk when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? You know all that? No. You can. You almost sound like a TV evangelist. That is awful. There is what they call a leviathan of nature, a leviathan, which is a great fish. And this is what Jesus symbolized. He was the great fisherman, the leviathan of the deeps. Now, this leviathan of the deeps, this that you want to know, is not to be drawn out of the great sea of mystery by the fishhook of man's mind. It is not quite that easy. How often can you remember of being totally filled with awe, standing in front of something, or maybe even a thought of it, an idea of it, brings something about so that you are just standing there in awe. This whole panorama that is here. You look out there and you see this nature. You know, and sometimes I wonder, you know, if we as a people are not so saturated with things that we have forgotten what awe is. You know, to be capable, to be able to be in this state of awe, and that awe is so penetrating that all thinking stops. Everything stops, as it were. Suddenly, time is not. Space is not. You don't even try to figure anything out. You know. Not in that moment. It's just filled with this, what we call awe. How long has it been since you have felt so near to this mystery of ourselves that you have allowed yourself to feel this awe? We're very busy learning systems. We learn something like Vedanta, or we learn something like Hare Krishna, or we learn something like Jainism or Buddhism or whatever. We study one of them, one at a time, mostly, usually. Some once in a while we study three or four together. And, you know, people do, you know, then they're going to see which one is the best. And so they get lost. We usually study one out of several techniques that are available to us. And then somehow we're very filled with confidence because now we know and we have forgotten to qualify that what we know is a technique, that what we know is a system, that what we know is a method. We can climb around all sorts of mental structures. And I know that Henry was, he tells of the time when he was with his teacher when he was 16. And this man would build for him out of one of the systems. He would build this beautiful mental structure. And then Henry would figure, well, now I know this. And he'd climb around in this thing and answer all kinds of questions. And then when he was really set in it, this is it, the teacher would come along and it was not. Took it all away from him. And so then he built him up another system. And then another system. And then another system. And in the meanwhile, you know, Henry being Henry, he got some ground under his feet so that he knew what he was about. But this is kind of what we do. We get a hold of a system and we build a mental structure. And we climb around in it mentally, and that's what we're doing, and we don't know it. We think we're on a long path getting to know something, and all we're doing is climbing around it with these ideas. Systems. We think we know. Yeah. And then, of course, we are very confident because we know we're better than everybody else. We begin to think almost. Not almost. Sometimes we do. What about the awe? When something is discovered that has been so mysterious or appears so mysterious, what about this awe? Is it in any of the systems? See, we bump our noses against this mysteriousness that we are all the time, and we ignore it. It's a mystery. How did we come to be here? What will occur when we are not here? What will we be when we are not here? It's really very mysterious. In the olden days, the word awful was a religious word. It was a holy word and it was sacred. Now when we feel terrible, we say, I feel awful. I feel bad. Awful. And maybe it shows by and large what we have done with this awe. We have so ignored it that we allow the fear to overpower that tremendous peace that is also in this awe. People used to be awful when they were in deep prayer or when something was revealed to them of the divine. That is, they had an insight and then they had this awe as to what they actually saw then. See, there was a revelation of this divine nature taking place. They were awful. Not horrible, not bad, but full of awe. That's what awful means. The word used to mean, you know, if you were awful, you were at the top of everything. You were a tip-top because, gee whiz, you know, something was being revealed to you. You had insight. So as the Japanese would say, you were Ichiban at the very top. And, you know, very positive. And now, of course, it's very negative. And I think maybe that because when people do feel awe, this overwhelming awe, you know, the aftermath of it sometimes is fear. They are overwhelmed by a mystery. They are overwhelmed by this unknown, this very unfamiliar, strange other world. And it's, you know, something so much greater than anything that we know of, you know, greater even than ourselves, which makes it pretty great, huh? You betcha. So this being greater than me, it makes me feel pretty small and pretty useless. It is not something that you can control. See, you can't manipulate it. You can't own it. It just, all of a sudden, you're surrounded with it. You're inundated with it. It's vaster than anything you've ever known. And you're just at a standstill, you know, kind of like you're at a loss. And so after that, you begin to feel a little fearful. You have a negative reaction after it. So they say that fear follows awe. But I don't understand this, really. Of course, this is coming from me now. Why don't we feel full of joy after we've had this awe state? Why fear? Why not this tremendous joy? We're left with a puzzlement, that's true. But a puzzlement shouldn't necessarily be fearful, should it? I can remember when I was a child and I came tromping down the back steps and here's this little flower sitting there and it's got a dewdrop in the center of it and it's morning and the sun is shining and all of a sudden, here was this whole shining universe. An 8-year-old kid doesn't understand that, really. And yet an 8-year-old kid does understand it. This empty shiningness that was the universe. And everything was this, whatever this was. And I knew it was true. But where is it hiding itself? Puzzlement. Why didn't I see it all the time? Puzzlement. Why didn't I want to talk about it to others? It was a secret that I had glimpsed. I left it at that. You know, and in the olden days of religion, they spoke of God as the mysterium and the tremendum. Now, it's a mystery that can never be solved. And it's a tremendum because one feels so small before it. It may be that in this tremendum, this vastness, that a fear springs forth. You cannot ever, not ever, win your own way from this tremendousness. Tremendum. You can't cajole it. You can't placate it. You can't bargain with it. You can't manipulate it. You can't have tantrums and have your own way. It is implacable in what it is. So what seems frightening to some, to others is really reassuring. How reassuring, how secure to know there is something that you can't trick, something that you have to accept just as it is. Security. And yet, we say to ourselves, if I accept that, maybe I will be no more. You will be. Never a time was not when you were not. If you accept that mysterium and that tremendum, that is what you will be. It's your rock, and it's your faith. Now, it has been said also that philosophy, the love of wisdom, philosophy, rises out of wonder, and religion rises out of awe. And there is a little different stance, a little difference in the two of them. Wonder, something is a wonderment, and so you want a clue. You want to think about it. You're going to try to figure it out. So a wonder creates a kind of a question mark, and that you can struggle with. And you try to explain this wonder. A philosopher tries to find some answer of the mystery so there will be no more mystery. The religion rises in awe. Awe has the quality of wonder about it, but it is one step deeper. One can be it without knowing it. You don't have to have an answer. You don't create the same kind of question marks, because there is in it this you seem to find at the same time this love. See? You find this humbleness in it. See? It creates a state. You're just in the awe, you know, and there's not much of anything else you really want to do, because it contains so much. Questions are not formable. To question, you know, we have to use descriptive words. And here, you know, in this mysterium, we have no form to talk about. What kind of words are you going to use? One doesn't question the dewdrop, why it's there, you know. One simply marvels. And it never leaves the marvel. There is something, and it appears to us. And this is not all of it. This is not the end of it. What it is, I'll find out someday. And in the meanwhile, just let me go my way to find it. Then, of course, somebody will say, well, of course I want to know. I want to know that. I want to know that tremendous vastness, you know, that was before anything and which will be after everything. I want to know what I am. But please, I must insist that I be present all the time. Me, as I am now, I'm going to go along with it, you know. Well, you will, but not quite like you think. No? Just kind of open some of the doors and open some of the windows and let the air flow through and let some sunshine flow through. Go after some of the important questions. All the rest are called irritations of the mind. And we know those quite well. You know, theologians used to sit and argue over the question, how many angels can dance on the point of a pin? It used to be quite a favorite of theirs. You know, what difference does it make? I mean, it's not of any importance. It is an irritation of the mind. They would sit there and chew their fingernails and, well, what do you think? How many angels can dance on the point of a pin? 10,000? And even if I said only 5, how would I prove it? So they would sit there, you know. And but people, you know, when they begin to feel this, and this mysteriousness and this tremendousness, they suddenly begin to look around, you know, and make sure I'm here, don't let me lose myself, I'm here. And they can't let go to something in themselves that is greater than this that I know every day. And every day you know it. You know, it's like Roshi had a visitor, and it was a general of the army. And so the Roshi invited him to have some tea, and they had tea in these little cakes that they had, little cookies, you know. So while they're sitting there, you know, the Roshi's waiting. This guy came for some reason. He wants to ask a question, so we'll wait and see what this question is. So finally the general asks, you know, and he says, I do have this question that has been bothering me, and I would like to talk to you about it. And the Roshi says, okay. And this general says, what is it that we use every day and don't know? And instead of answering him, the Roshi picks up the plate and says, would you have another cake? And the general picks up the other cake and begins to eat it. And then he repeats his question, what is it that we use every day and don't know? So Roshi says, yeah, what is it that we use every day and don't know? Now, that's an important question. What is it that we use every day and don't know? But you know, we get to a certain place and something, this ego, of course, is what it is. It says, let's not bother with this for right now. We'll do it later. You know, later it'll be gone or something like that, you know? And I've got to be sure that I'm going to be here. I've got to stay here. You know, it's kind of like going on a vacation. You're going to go to another country and you're going to see all these wonderful places, but at the last minute, you're dragging your heels and can't go because you can't take your garden with you, or you can't take your bathroom with you, or you can't take your car with you, you know. You can't take your bed with you. That's what you're trying to do when you like that. Jesus said, you know, those who want to follow me to deny everything, including themselves. And you don't have to be afraid of it because you're not going to disappear. You will be forever. Between the state where you are now and where you wish to be, the state where you wish to be, let us say, for the sake of whatever, just whatever, you want to be one of those who knows. So let us say you want to be a master. You want to be a Roshi. You want to be a knower. So between the state of a disciple and a master, it seems to take such a long, long, long time. All these cotton-picking things we got to do. We're told all the time to observe. I'm observing. Oh, yes, I am. I'm observing. And I've got to sit. Well, so I sit now and then. So it takes a long time. You know that the whole thing could take place right now. If you will stop defending yourself. To stop rationalizing with yourself. You know. Why you did what you did, all your actions and your reactions. And we have become past masters at this. Now, when one gets into this state of awe, and you know, it's a nice thing to sit with. It opens all kinds of doors. It's not better than niggling at ourselves as to what am I doing here. You know jolly well what you're doing here. But when you can get in this awe, if you can stay in it for a little while, there comes this 180-degree turn of consciousness. Your body doesn't move. It's the consciousness that moves. Now, if you can not disrupt this particular turn, you know, don't corrupt it with thinking. You know, don't have any thoughts about it. Don't rationalize about it. Don't look to your defenses. If you just remain, just remain, just being in it, in this turn. And this turn is what Christianity calls conversion. You know, it doesn't mean you're a Hindu and you have become a Christian, or you're a Buddhist and you become a Christian. This is a turn of consciousness. And if you can hold that, suddenly it is as if you disappear and reappear. And you'll be face to face with being. This being that is hidden within you. God in here. Now comes knowing, because God knows. And this is what is called noesis, knowing, that kind of knowing. And there is a story about this that you might like. When God created this world, he came here to live. See? But there was such great trouble for him. He could hardly get any time to sleep because people were coming and complaining. And they were complaining and they were complaining. The whole day long he had to make time for trying to solve people's problems. And then even in the night they came knocking at the door, they had a problem. And of course also there were all these suggestions to improve on the system. You know, hardly anybody was satisfied with it. You know, almost tore his hair out. You know. It looked as if nothing was going right. There were millions of advisors out there, and he just got fed up. So if he listened to one man's advice, there were 1,001 against that advice. So, difficult to do anything. So he called a meeting, all his counselors and his advisors. He got them all together and explained the situation, and he said, "What should I do? I would like to hide somewhere. I don't want to be this accessible." I mean, listen to all that, those questions. I mean, you know, what do people very often go to God with? "Please take this obstacle out of my way. Please, you know, my husband should be faithful. Tell me if he is." And, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. You know, he's too busy for that. And he says, "I need a place to hide so that I am not bothered with this kind of question." So one of the advisors suggested that he go to the top of Mount Everest. And he said, "No one will ever be able to come up there. You make your home on the top of this mountain." Well, God said, "You don't know the future." Within a few minutes, you know, and it's for God, centuries or minutes, for seconds. You know, he says, "In a few minutes, why, Hillary's going to climb that mountain. And then I won't be alone anymore. I'll be accessible. And when he sees me, why, then everybody knows about it, and they'll all start coming, you know." So another one said, "Well, how about going living on the moon?" "Well, no, that's only a question of a few minutes, too. And there could be a lot of people walking on the moon. So that's not going to solve anything. It may postpone it a little, but it's not going to solve anything." So then one very old counselor came up, and he whispered something into God's ear. And God looked at him and he slapped his knee and he happily said, "Right on!" You know? This appears to be the perfect situation, solution. See? Now, what do you think that old man had suggested? Well, you hide yourself in man. Yeah. He will never find you. And even if he finds a man who is so wise as to find God within himself, will not create any trouble for God. Hillary's may. They can create problems, but Buddhas will not. Not by the time they find the you within themselves. They will be almost like you. They will not have any complaints. They will not have any questions. They will be as silent as you. They will be as deep as you. By the time they reach you within themselves, they will have been transformed. The very journey will see to that. You know, in our seeking, One of the things we seek in our lives is understanding. You know, as Solomon said, with all you're getting, get understanding. Well, now that's difficult. And we go around, if we could only understand this, and if we could only understand that, and if we could only understand the other. When somebody asks us something, with this mysterious fish hook of the mind, we reach into our memory bank, we reach into our thinking for an answer. We thought about it. And through this process, understanding disappears. Understanding, the understanding in the wisdom of Solomon, is pure intelligence. It is originally yours. It has always been yours. No one has ever taken it away. It is yours now, pure intelligence. You're born with it. You will die with it. I hope you come to an acquaintanceship or a relationship with it so you can at least shake hands with it, huh? Understanding. Yeah. Through deep meditation, one sharpens it. Through meditation, one drops what one has borrowed. One reclaims one's own originality. One reclaims one's own innocence, one's own freshness. And out of this innocence, you act out of understanding. That's spontaneity. So instead of reaching into the mind and looking for the answer, you just simply look at the question. And you keep right on looking at the question. How do you think these koans work? You look at the question. You're silent. You just shut up. And you look at the question. You don't look into the memory. You look at the question, that you face it, you know. You meet it right on. And then if you don't know what to say, you say, I don't know. Bodhidharma could say it, you can certainly say it. I mean, this man knew for sure, and he could still say, I don't know. And when Emperor Wu asked him who he was, I don't know. He is still this mysterium present, huh? If somebody, for instance, asks you, does God exist or not? Does God exist? Well, you immediately say what? Well, yes, he does. I mean, what's the use of all his sitting if he doesn't exist? I guess that's why you say it. One of the reasons. Why would you say, yes, God does exist? Why would you say that? Why would you answer that? Where does the answer come from? How many times have you met him so that you could say, yeah, I know that he is? Is it just the answer out of a Christian memory or a Muslim memory? Yes, God does exist. It's certainly not a Buddhist memory. They don't talk about God. They talk about the everlasting light. If the answer is no, God does not exist, then perhaps it's from a communist or an atheistic point of view memory. If you're face to face with the question, does God exist? To make an effort to understand, your answer probably would be, after just looking at the question, I don't know. If you've realized God, then you might say, well, something is for sure. Something is. And out of understanding, what you say out of understanding is true. This I don't know, saying I don't know, this kind of an ignorance, this kind of an honesty, it has a value because one has accepted simply this I don't know. And this kind of ignorance is very close to the truth. It's very close to the truth. One is not trying to pretend and one is not a hypocrite. I don't know. You know, it's, you know, the story of the monks asking the Roshi, the question, and then they asked, which is more intimate? Which is most intimate? I don't know. It's most intimate. So we learn to observe, and this is a very key question, word, practice. Observe. Watch. Observe. You can begin to see when your answers come from memory. You can watch, and you will see where your memory does not function. Where only consciousness functions. Observe. These are the things you should be observing. You don't come and tell me, oh yeah, I noticed today there was a new flower at the neighbor's house. I'm not interested in the flower at the neighbor's house. I'm interested in what's going on in here with you, huh? Yeah. There was once upon a time, there was a great flood in India, and this is fact. And there was a Baal master who developed a camp. It was an ashram type of thing to take in the victims of this flood. He wanted to help them. And one of his disciples saved the life of a woman. And when he brought her in, she was almost totally unconscious. She was half unconscious. He had found her, and he'd seen her in the river, there at flood, clinging to a tree. And she was clinging to the tree with one arm, and with the other arm, she clasped her baby. You know, and here she was herself about to go under. Her husband had disappeared before her eyes. And anyway, he got her out of the water, and he brought her to the ashram, and she lived there, and she became a very humble servant. And the baby grew up there and became a very fine young girl. They all cared about her. She was a very, very fine person. Now, when she was 10, and remember, this is India, and they have their systems. When she was 10, the guru of this particular ashram decided that she should be married. And there was a young novice, same caste as she, and this guru chose this particular young man, whose name was Shankar, to be her husband. And it was, the young man thought it was very curious in a way, because he had come to the ashram to become a monk, and here now the guru is giving him a wife. But anyway, the guru gave this young woman, this young girl, Pushpa, to Shankar, and he gave her a dowry, and he acted as if he were her father. And she went out with the two monks to the marriage ceremony. And when the wedding feast was over, she came back to live in the ashram with this her adopted father, as with the teacher. Huh? And that was according to custom, tradition. It was a child marriage, but only when she was of a certain age could she go and live with him. Her husband came to visit her on feast days. He had, in the meantime, found a very good job. And when she was 15, he took her home, and their married life began. 2 years later, when she was close to 18, Pushpa had a son, to her great delight. And then the baby died in infancy. Now, faced with this death, this young mother turned within, to the place where she could remain a spectator of her own grief. She became the witness to her grief. And she would say to the people who offered sympathy, this is how it happened. The child smiled, and then it was all over. And she knew, too, that for herself, her marriage was over because she couldn't have any more children. So the child smiled, and then it was all over. Now, she adored her husband with all the ardor of an 18-year-old, and I don't think there's anything worse. Oh, this 18-year-old ardor, huh? Anyway, it's also very beautiful, but it's very full of tension. Yeah. And a year later, When she felt sure of her own reactions, see, all this while she'd been training herself, her reactions, a year later, she said to her husband, "You must take another wife. I cannot look at your mother as long as she has not my grandson in her arms." So Pushpa had made inquiry about a certain young girl in the village and told Shankar about her. And as Shankar said nothing, he didn't say a, nay, or whatever, you know, she arranged the marriage. And then she went away on a long pilgrimage in the mountains. And when she returned after many, many months, she said to the second wife, "May there never be any bad feeling between us. Shankar is yours. You are here to serve him in everything. I chose you to give him children." And she made her position very clear. Every once in a while, she would go away. And no one knew where she went except Shankar and, of course, the guru, the master of the ashram. And he tells, it is he that is telling this story. And he said in telling it, "She used to come and visit me. When she comes, each time she brings questions which have ripened slowly and are filled out by her experiences. She listens to what I have to say with the intelligence of the heart that perceives what is hidden by the obscurity of the ego. She has discarded so many things that she tastes life at its source. What she understands, she makes use of. And when she leaves here, she takes with her only what is true for her. Because of this, people are happy to be near her. Life has taught her that every sensation lights the flame of a little lamp in us. What matters is not to have at the same moment opposite sensations, not to allow them to rise that will start a big fire. One sensation at a time is enough. But that one sensation has color, smell, sound. It is even tangible. This sensation has an identity. Something in us knows perfectly well where it comes from and what it is worth. Observing, you will only know that by observation, that every sensation lights the flame of a little lamp in us. Only by watching, only by observation. So then observation is the training of yourself. It's the disciplining of yourself to watch within. Okay. Okay. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.